Now, studying the book of Genesis, but still in the 28th chapter of Genesis, we're now ready to begin at the 16th verse. The setting for this passage is that Jacob has now started on the long journey from Beersheba to go to Haran, there to find a wife among his mother's family, and also to escape the wrath of Esau, who threatened to kill him. And this is about 10 or 12 miles north of what we now know as Jerusalem. He comes to the place that we know as Bethel. Bethel has been described as a pretty desolate place. It's described as a bleak, open wasteland with large bare rocks exposed. It's 1,200 feet above sea level in the hills. And some say that there are many places in the desert of California that would correspond to this place known as Bethel. And no doubt, Jacob is homesick. This may be his first night to really spend away from home. He is at the beginning of a long, hard journey, 500 miles he's going to have to make to get over to Haran. He's never been there before. And as he puts a rock down and lays down on it to sleep, he has this dream. And in the dream, or this vision that he has, he sees this ladder that goes from earth to heaven. He sees the Lord at the head of the ladder, and he sees the angels going up and down the ladder carrying out their business. And we talked about this in our last lesson, how that this is a picture of the angels of heaven acting as ministering servants to God's people here on earth, and how the Lord is in charge of it all, and how this ladder is actually a type of Christ, who is the door for man to be able to get to heaven. So let us read the description of it again in verse 12. And he dreamed, and beheld a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. Well, during this dream and this vision, God again renewed to Jacob the promise. So let's read about that, verses 13 through 15. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it into thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. And thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee, and in thy seed, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places where thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And then verse 16 says, this is where our lesson begins today, and Jacob awaked out of his sleep. And he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. So here Jacob is surprised now at what he has realized and what he has envisioned during this dream. He said, surely the Lord is in this place. I mean, this was the Lord that had appeared to him in his dream. And he'd actually been able to see this vision and its reality and its truthfulness. He says, surely the Lord's in this place. He had left home. He might have had in his mind that God was omnipotent, that God was every place, but he really had never dealt with God outside of maybe his own home area, where there they had the altar and there they could worship God and there they had the familiar things. But now here he is out in the desert. He is lonely. It's maybe his first night out on his own like this. He is maybe homesick. He lays down on this rock as a pillow, and here God is appearing to him. God is in this place. So he realizes that God can be any place. God can be any place that he is, and God will be with him. And God is with him. God is with him here in this place. And so he said, the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. He really wasn't expecting to find the Lord here like he did. And so let us realize that wherever we are, the Lord can be there. If we are going to be in harmony with the Lord will be there. And let us not sell God short. He can be any place. He can be any place that's compatible with him. Now, if we decide to go someplace that's ungodly, someplace that is a place that's not going to be appropriate for God to be meeting with us, then that's a different matter. But just because we're alone and away from home, just because we're in a place where there are no friends or no one that can really help us, and we're having to kind of go it on our own, as it were, God can still be there, and he will be there, and he can be worshipped there, actually. And so verse 17 says, and he was afraid, and said, how dreadful is this place? So he called this place dreadful, not because it was bad, not because it was something that was horrible, but because it was awesome. The appearance of God in this place is something that would not be thought of in any way except with holy awe and reverence and respect. He's thinking here, I shall have a respect for this place. I'll remember it by the fact that this is where I saw God in a vision. As long as I live, I'll remember this. This is a place to never forget. And in that sense, it's dreadful in the sense that it's a place of holy awe and reverence. The NIV translates this word dreadful as awesome. How awesome is this place? And so we then should never take God for granted. And there was nothing about the place itself, about the location of it, or about the furnishing of it, or about the trappings of it that made it so great and awesome, but it was the fact that God was there. That's what made the place a place that was what he called an awesome place or a dreadful place. And it's something that he would never forget. This was, as it were, a place out in the desert that had now become the house of God, the residence of the divine majesty, the gate of heaven. That is the place where Jacob saw the angels, the inhabitants of the upper world, going in and out of heaven and back to earth as they were climbing up and down this ladder. And so here the angels were ascending and descending. They were like travelers passing and repassing through the gates of a city, and Jacob would never forget this. It's a wonderful place of reverential awe for him to even think about it. And so when we see that we're meeting with God, with his special presence, we ought to meet with him with the most humble reverence, remembering his justice and holiness and our own lowliness and unworthiness. And any meeting with God is an awesome experience, actually. And so Jacob says in the last of the verse 17, this is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven, simply because of God's presence. God can be present any place on the face of this earth. Anywhere his servants are, God can be there. God will be there if they but be faithful to God. Verse 18 says, and Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. So Jacob now feels that this is the place where there should be an altar. This should be a place of worship to God. He didn't have anything there really to make an altar out of or the time to do it this time. So he took the stone that he had used for a pillar. He set that up. And then he poured oil on the top of it. This would be some kind of a ceremonial act, I'm sure. This oil would be like kind of like a poor offering. He didn't have anything to offer in the way of an animal, no blood sacrifice, but the poor offering, the oil offering on it. And this would be a place he would remember. He would never forget this place, and he would come back here. As a faithful descendant of Abraham, Jacob had no doubt been well instructed in the essential importance of the altar and the sacrifices made there upon the altar, and how that this is a place where a person could call upon the name of the Lord. And so he here begins the building of an altar at this place, and he felt like that this was a place that it was so appropriate that there should be an altar to commemorate it with. Verse 19 says, and he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at the first. This word Bethel means the house of God. Jacob looked upon this place as a place that should be known as the house of God. And it has become a very famous place. Actually, Abraham went to this place over 100 years before when he was first called from Haran to come into the land of Canaan. And as he came into the land of Canaan, we read in Genesis 12, begins verse 6, and Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Sychem, unto the plain of Morah, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram, and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, who appeared unto him, and removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. So in this vicinity, Abram had before built this altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. And it's quite possible that Jacob might have known that or remembered that, but Abram was here long before Jacob was. But now Jacob gives the name Bethel to it. We notice that Genesis 12 also calls it Bethel. That may be an editorial insertion that Moses put there so that we would know that Abraham was at the place that was the same as where Jacob was. But originally it said the name of that city was called Luz at the first, or that place was called Luz. But here, Jacob names it Bethel. And to show how famous this place was in Bible history, let us read some of the things that the Bible dictionary says about this place called Bethel. It's described as an area 12 miles north of Jerusalem, near the spot where Ephraim and Benjamin joined when they had their tribal boundaries. The place was an ancient Canaanite town and was connected with the early patriarchs. Abraham camped near it on first entering Canaan, Genesis 12:8, and later built an altar there, Genesis 13:4. And as we read in our text here, we see that Jacob was the one who gave the name to the place after he'd seen this ladder extending from earth to heaven. And Jacob returned here after his sojourn with Laban, Genesis 35:1-9. The area here was in Benjamin's territory, Joshua 18:21. It was captured by the sons of Joseph, Judges 1:23-26. And here the Ark of God rested for a time, Judges 20:26-28. And here Samuel went to judge Israel, 1 Samuel 7:16-10:3. Jeroboam set up one of his two golden calves at Bethel, 1 Kings 12:26-30. Because of its place as a center of idolatry, it was later denounced by the prophets, Hosea 4:15, Amos 3:14, and 4:4. And we see that people from Bethel are listed among the returning exiles in Nehemiah 7:32 and Ezra 2:28. So the history of this area known as Bethel stretches from early to late Old Testament times, with more mention than any other Old Testament place except Jerusalem. The modern site is called Beitin, B-E-I-T-I-N. So we see how absolutely famous and renowned this place of Bethel became in Old Testament times. And here's one of the greatest events associated with it, Jacob's dream, where he sees the ladder. And verse 20 says, "And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God." Here we see that Jacob is taking a vow. And some have tried to dilute this vow by saying that when Jacob says, if God be with me, that he's trying to bargain with God. He's trying to deal with God. He's trying to put some terms up for God to meet, if God will do so and so. But other Bible scholars say that this word if can be translated since instead of if. That there is nothing in the Hebrew to keep the statement from reading, since God will be with me and will keep me. And that's what I really believe he's saying here. He's not trying to bargain with God. He has had a shaking experience. He has got a promise from God. He is a believer in God. He's not trying to be willy-nilly about this thing and put God to some kind of a challenge or test now. The context doesn't say that at all. But he's really saying, since God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. Notice what Jacob is asking for. He's asking for God to be with him. He's asking for God to keep him in this way that I go. He wants to make a safe journey where he's going. Because he's going back to Haran, to his mother's family. It's a far off place. He's praying for God to be with him in this journey. It's a prayer that we today make many times when we take journeys. Much shorter journeys than one Jacob's taking here. One that's much less arduous than what he's taking. But yet we pray for God to have us, to have a safe journey, to be with us, to keep us. Keep me in the way as I go. Give me bread to eat. That's not asking for anything elaborate. Bread to eat. Jesus said when he taught his disciples to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." We ask for simple things from God, the necessities of God. God's going to give them to us, but he wants us to ask for them. He expects us to ask for them. And then he says, and raiment to put on. Give me bread, give me clothes, give me safe journey. That's what he's asking for. real simple, but yet the basic needs that he must have to be successful here. And then he says in verse 22, "And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." So this is going to be a place known as God's house. I'll not forget this place. This stone here is a remembrance to me that this will be known as God's house. And he does come back here and he does build the altar here. It is going to be a place of worship. And as we see the long history of this place of Bethel in the Old Testament, how it is used in many, many ways and regarded as a high and holy place, a place that is famous and used in the service of God. It's also abased, it's also degraded and used in the service of idols, and it's denounced when it becomes like that. But let us never forget that it does not matter how much a place is used for the proper service of God, how much good worship is given to God, how high and holy God is regarded to be in a place, it can still be changed so it becomes a house of idolatry. We can desecrate it. We can change it. We can move the idols in, the things that are ungodly in, the things that are not the ways of God in, and God will leave. Then it's the place to be cursed. It's the place to be denounced. And that's what happened to Bethel, actually. And then in the last of verse 22, Jacob says, "And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." He pledges to give a tithe to God. Now, we don't know of any written law at this time that called for tithing. Tithes were something that were given in the law of Moses as a law. But at this time, there was no law requiring tithing. But here we see that he pledges to give a tithe to God. Abraham had given tithe to Melchizedek earlier. So now Jacob is pledging to give a tithe. And since there was no law requiring this, we see that both Abraham and Jacob was doing this purely as a voluntary matter, as an expression of their thanksgiving to God. They volunteered to give a tithe to God. There was no law requiring it. And so the same is with us today. Whatever we give today should be something that's voluntary. It's not something that should be required of us to do. That's something we give grudgingly. That's something we give because we have a law that says count out and give so much. But it's a voluntary thing. That's the motive that we should have when Christians today give to God. And if they give a tenth of their possessions and income, that's quite all right. There's no law against that. They can very well do that. There's no law requiring tithing as a condition for salvation or even of God's blessings for immaterial things. But we can give more than a tithe. We're not limited to a tenth. There is no law that says we give a tenth. We give according to how we've been prospered. And we give according to the way that we're motivated in our heart to do so. So giving to the Lord is an expression of love and concern for the Lord and His service. We give it because we love the Lord. There is no legalistic specification of exactly one-tenth to be set aside for God. If there were, we couldn't give over one-tenth. But never let us forget, though, that the Bible does give us a command about this thing of giving. In 1 Corinthians 16:1-2, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come." This is the way the NIV reads on those two scriptures of 1 Corinthians 16:1-2. "Now about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches to do. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collection would have to be made." So we have a very definite command in the Bible to take a collection on the first day of the week for the work of God. And the Apostle Paul says more about this act of laying by in store in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Let me read, begin with verse 5. "Therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you, and make up beforehand your bounty, whereof you had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty, and not as of covetousness. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, And he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Let every man according as he hath purposed in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. Now let me read that same passage, 1 Corinthians 9, beginning with verse 5, from the NIV translation. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift you had promised. Then it will be ready as a generous gift, not as one grudgingly given. Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Every man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly, nor under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. So we're told very plainly here that this is according to what we've purposed in our heart or what we've prospered. That's how we give. And it's not because we're compelled to do something. That's not the reason we give. We give because we want to. We give because it's a cheerful thing for us to do it. God loves a cheerful giver. And he says here very plainly that you're gonna reap like you sow. If you sow sparingly, you'll reap sparingly. If you sow bountifully, you're going to reap bountifully. And he's talking about this collection taken on the first day of the week. That's how we're going to prosper, according to how we give to that. The Apostle Paul concludes in verse 8 of 2 Corinthians 9 by saying, And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. So as we do good works, God is able to repay us in turn with good works. And God can give us all grace, including our monetary supply of goods, our money. God gives those to us. And so, although we're not commanded to give a tenth, since we see the great example from Abraham to Jacob and on through of giving a tenth, it is most appropriate for us today to give a tenth or more rather than less. That's our lesson. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.